Now to news of books, the provocative, the best-selling, and the cheap. Starting with that big online price war between retail giants Walmart, Target, and Amazon, it's prompted the American Booksellers Association to ask for an investigation by the Justice Department into what the ABA calls predatory pricing. NPR's Richard Gonzalez has more.
In a letter to the Justice Department, the American Booksellers Association, or ABA, says that a price war between the retailers is damaging the book industry and harmful to consumers. The ABA is a trade organization of locally owned independent booksellers. Its letter follows moves by Amazon, Target, and Walmart towards an online price war in the pre-sale of new hardcover bestsellers. Books by authors such as John Grisham, Stephen King, and Barbara Kingsolver that typically sell for between $25 and $35 are being offered at $10 or less, even as low as $8.98 on Walmart.com. The booksellers say they can't compete with such low prices. They argue the retailers can afford to take a loss on the bestsellers in order to attract customers to other more profitable merchandise. Representatives for the Justice Department, Amazon, Target, and Walmart were not available for comment. Richard Gonzalez, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Good morning. Now that airbags are widely accepted in cars, they're about to make their way onto airplanes. Several airlines have begun outfitting some of their seats to comply with an FAA rule that takes full effect today. NPR's Adam Hochberg reports.
There was a time, maybe 25 years ago, when the idea of putting airbags in planes would have been seen as pointless. For decades, aviation safety focused mainly on avoiding accidents, on the theory that if a crash occurred, nobody could survive anyway. But more recently, safety experts have discovered that even in major mishaps, like planes running off runways or landing in the Hudson River, passengers can walk away unharmed if they're properly protected. And that's where airbags can help.
So here's a typical airbag assembly.
Tom Barth is research director of a company called AmSafe. It makes most of the seatbelts used on planes. And increasingly, it's been selling belts with airbags attached. At this factory in Phoenix, workers put them together. They load a deflated airbag into a narrow pouch on top of the belt and connect it to a trigger mechanism and helium-filled inflation device that will be hidden under the seat.
The airbag seatbelt looks pretty much like a standard seatbelt, so the person using it uses it like any other belt. And then on top of the seatbelt, you have the airbag sewn onto the webbing and covered with a decorative cover. People don't really notice that it's there.
AmSafe now is supplying the product to most major U.S. airlines to help comply with a new government crash standard. The rule's been phased in slowly over the past 21 years and takes full effect this week when the seats in newly manufactured planes will have to protect passengers from a crash 16 times the force of gravity. That's roughly what you might experience in a moderate speed head-on car wreck. John Hickey at the Federal Aviation Administration says the new standard is an improvement over the former requirement of 9 times gravity force, which he says didn't provide adequate protection.
We were seeing accidents that, sure, some of them were terrible catastrophes and there was never going to be a survivor. But many of the accidents were of the nature that people were still in their seat, and if maybe it was a little bit stronger, that person could have survived.
Hickey says airbags are just one of several methods airlines can use to comply with the rule, and only a few seats on a typical plane would need them. They're unnecessary, for instance, in most of the coach cabin because airlines are installing sturdier seat backs. In a collision, those seat backs serve as an adequate cushion. Other seats, in especially spacious configurations, comply with the standard simply because there's nothing in front of them a belted passenger could hit. But where the bags often are used is in places like the bulkhead, the wall at the front of the cabin, where a crash could throw passengers into a hard surface.
We'll do this crash test, and a whole series of things will happen.
Back at AmSafe, Executive Vice President Bill Hagan leads us to a long, narrow room, where two crash test dummies sit in a mock-up of an airplane cabin. The dummies hit the bulkhead at a force of 16 Gs. Then Hagan assesses the results.
The occupant in the right-hand seat was wearing just a regular two-point seatbelt. And if you look at the bulkhead in front of him, you can see a tan mark where his head struck and skidded on the bulkhead. So that's just not survivable. And the occupant on the left has the seatbelt airbag and never touched the bulkhead.
Hagen says about 1% of the world's commercial aircraft seats now are equipped with airbags, a number he says will increase as airlines replace older planes. Each of the devices costs about $1,200, compared with just $35 for a standard seatbelt. But Hagen argues they're worth the price. Though an airbag never has deployed on a commercial flight, he says several have gone off in private plane crashes, and he credits them for saving 14 lives. Adam Hochberg, NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. Today in Your Health, we have the second of two reports about mental health problems on campus. The number of students seeking psychiatric help is on the rise. That's true from small community colleges to elite universities. Last week, we told you about the problem. Today, NPR's Deborah Franklin tells us what some schools are doing about it.
A new crop of freshmen arrived on the Stanford University campus in California last month. It was a blue sky day as they stood in line outside the dorms waiting for room assignments from the student resident assistants.
Got your name tag and all that jazz, PO box key, in this little packet.
Looking on, Stanford residence dean, Arcadio Morales. He and his family have an apartment in the dorms, and he's helped usher in every new class for 15 years. In a quieter moment, Morales told us that there have always been some students who pack emotional baggage along with their laptops and books, but the mix of problems he sees have changed.
Early on, most of the issues that surface were roommate issues, sort of compatibility issues.
He still gets that stuff, along with anxiety over midterms. But these days, Morales is seeing some more serious mental health issues, too.
We're getting students that wouldn't have been here 10 years ago because they're on antidepressants or antipsychotic medication, and they're functioning, you know, fairly well.
But it can be a big challenge for the colleges when these students have crises, which has been happening more often at Stanford and other schools. Those middle-of-the-night calls are very hard for any school and any student.
I was just going through a depression, but it was a depression that was getting worse and worse.
Amanda Gellander, now a Stanford senior, has bipolar disorder with symptoms that are mostly evened out with medication. But that night in the dorm 2 years ago, the bottom fell out, and she called a family member.
I was in hysterical tears. I was making remarks, you know, what's the point, you know, just things that a depressed person would say. I was really sad.
But not suicidal, she says. She just needed to vent. After that, Amanda hung up the phone and went to sleep. She had no idea her family was worried enough to call 911.
And about an hour later, there's banging on my door. I go to the door. There's two armed police who barge in. And they're talking about, you know, where are your pills? Where are your pills? And they start ransacking through my entire room. They're opening drawers. They're going through my shelves. And I'm half naked. I'm dressed for bed. And, you know, they're like, are you going to kill yourself? Are you going to kill yourself? I'm just like, no, I'm not going to kill myself. And they're threatening to take me to the psych ward. And they've got their handcuffs in their hands. And I don't know what you say to convince someone that you're not going to kill yourself besides, no, I'm not going to kill myself.
The police phoned the psychiatrist on call, and after some back and forth, they left. But the whole experience left Amanda horribly shaken. She understands the police have been asked to deal with suicide threats this way. It's protocol. She doesn't blame her family. They just wanted to keep her safe.
But that's the option that loved ones have. If they fear for someone, they have to call the police.
Of course, figuring out on the spot who's a risk to themselves and who's not isn't easy for anyone. Stanford's Arcadio Morales helps train student residence assistants in the dorms.
And I always tell the RAs, better to have someone angry and alive than dead and dead.
Everyone agrees it's much better to get help for a troubled student before they're in crisis. All across the U.S., concerned colleges, students, and parents are trying to do just that. Amanda Gellander started a theater project to bring mental illness into the light. And down the street from Stanford, a former Palo Alto mayor and his wife, Vic and Mary Ojakian, became mental health advocates after their son Adam died by suicide at the University of California, Davis, in 2004.
We determined that he became very anxious due to a certain situation, what's called a triggering event, and it was ultimately severe depression that caused his death.
Mary Ojakian and her husband didn't know their son was depressed. He never talked about it. But after Adam died, they interviewed his friends, people in the counseling center, police, professors, even the chancellor. And that's when they learned about the shortage of therapists on college campuses. and about how little training most faculty and even police get in how to recognize and handle mentally ill students.
We realized, and they realized, that there was a lot that could be done to change the situation on campus.
The whole situation just makes Vic Ojakian angry.
Guess what? What's going on right now isn't acceptable. We took a look at our situation, and we said to ourselves, we don't want another good human being dying. And we decided to do something about that, not to sit back, not to do another study. We decided we were going to go save lives.
Yeah, someone's got to draw the line.
Someone else has drawn the line, or tried to. The International Association of Counseling Services recommends that in order to keep students safe and healthy, a college campus should have a minimum of one therapist for every 1,000 to 1,500 students. When you fall short of that, and many colleges do, the wait lists for students seeking help can get very, very long. And research shows that students who get stuck on these wait lists are more likely to drop out of school. Vic Ojakian.
When you have an illness, most of us want to be treated immediately. If you break your arm, you don't want somebody saying to you, you're going to have to wait 2 to 6 weeks.
But that's the sort of wait time Stanford students faced last year until the university hired 6 more therapists. At the same time, it introduced a new system to triage phone calls so that the neediest students could get in to see a counselor right away. The university hired psychiatrist Dr. Ron Albuquer to head the counseling center.
It was a pretty intense trial by fire when I first got here. There were quite a few things going on at the same time.
Psychiatric hospitalizations were up. So were the number of students who needed medication as well as therapy. And most students who want or need long-term counseling still have to be referred to therapists off campus.
Because even with that many counselors, we're still incredibly busy.
When Stanford's endowment took a big hit last year and the school had to slash its budget, it chose not to lay off therapists. It did add a new fee for all students, about $500 a year, with most of that money going to mental health services. Daniel Eisenberg is a mental health researcher at the University of Michigan. He says in these very tight financial times, some other universities and colleges are making tough choices.
College campuses see their central mission as being education. And so I think there's sometimes a question about whether mental health services really fits into that central mission.
Vic and Mary Ojakian, whose son died in the midst of a deep depression, think society doesn't have a choice. Some big fixes will cost big money, and they think it's a good investment given the statistics. Half of all cases of mental illness first show up in the early teen years, and 75% by age 24. Vic Ojakian says college is prime time to intervene and get these young adults on a healthy path. He also has ideas for high school seniors and their parents.
For parents, they need to look at a college not just in terms of its academic credentials. They need to make sure that the mental health service they provide on campus, they need to get an idea of what they're doing and how well they're doing it.
Asking about the number of counselors and what services they have for students after hours. That's just a start, he says. Some other mental health tools are just as important and cheap enough that even financially strapped colleges should have them in place.
How do they communicate their services? Because that's a critical thing. You know, how do they use their web, some of these social networking tools? Do campuses have peer support groups?
Amanda Gellander, who was so depressed 2 years ago, says support from friends, family, and her doctor, along with a change in her medication, were all crucial to helping her get back on track.
Now, every day's a struggle, but I have more hope. I'm applying to a lot of postgraduate programs. I'm actually excited about my future.
Bipolar disorder is still a part of her, Amanda says, but it doesn't define her. Deborah Franklin, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Guy Raz. The sounds of the Holy Eucharist this morning at the National Cathedral here in Washington, D.C. It's a sacrament that millions of Anglicans, better known as Episcopalians here in North America, take part in each Sunday. Now, this past week, the Vatican made a stunning announcement that could prompt tens of thousands of Anglicans to become Roman Catholics. Here's Cardinal William Levada speaking at a press conference in the Vatican on Tuesday.
The Holy Father has approved an apostolic constitution which sets forth a canonical provision to facilitate a kind of corporate reunion of Anglican groups.
That means entire Anglican congregations will soon be able to convert to Catholicism en masse and still retain most of their traditions. The pronouncement addresses a schism between the two churches dating to the 1530s. Back then, the English king, Henry VIII, wanted his marriage to Catherine of Aragon annulled. Rome said no, so Henry broke with the Pope and proclaimed himself the head of the new Church of England. Now, today, the Anglican Communion has become one of the most liberal Christian denominations, and the Vatican says it's responding to pleas by thousands of disaffected Anglicans who disapprove of their church's decision on allowing women to become bishops and its tolerance of same-sex marriage. Now, Jim Naughton, canon for communications at the Episcopal Diocese here in Washington, doesn't believe too many Anglicans will take up the Vatican's offer, but I asked him whether he sees the announcement as a vote of no confidence in the Anglican Church.
I think it's fair to say that it's an affront just because of the clumsy way it was handled. I mean, I believe the Archbishop of Canterbury was actually on vacation.
He was unaware of this.
I'm told that sort of 2 weeks before it happened, he was given a bit of a heads up, but that was the end of it. But in terms of it being a vote of no confidence, I mean, who's allowed to suggest that the way another Christian faith pursues its business isn't sufficiently Christian?
Rowan Williams, the Archbishop of Canterbury, the worldwide head of the Anglican Church, released a statement that seemed to welcome this announcement. So did the North American Episcopal Church. Was that done for political reasons, or is that how they feel?
Well, I think the Archbishop of Canterbury had really very few alternatives other than to say, this isn't as bad as it looks. But again, I think for Episcopalians, what we need to do in the wake of this announcement is to continue going out there and saying, look, we do offer a very traditional liturgy, beautiful music, a style of worship that many people like, but we are a democratically governed church. We think men and women are equal at the altar, and we respect the dignity of gay and lesbian Christians. If that makes us outcasts, I think that that's a status that we embrace happily. So if what we're talking about here are people offering alternatives, I think Episcopalians offer that alternative to their Catholic brothers and sisters.
What do you think the Vatican is hoping to achieve here if you do not expect large numbers of Anglicans and Episcopalians here in the U.S. To become Roman Catholics?
I think this is an instance where some of the more conservative leaders within the Roman Curia have decided that there's an opportunity to try to weaken the Anglican Communion by sending a message that Rome disapproves of its policies. And so I think this is in many ways not the pastoral move it's being portrayed as, but is largely about sending a political message. And I think that what Anglicans have to say in response is that if indeed you want to define yourself as the church that will reach out to people who are dissatisfied over liberalization, go for it, because we do disagree with you. We just, after much prayer and study, we just think you're wrong.
Jim Naughton is the canon for communications with the Episcopal Diocese of Washington. Jim Naughton, thank you so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
So is this, as Jim Naughton argues, a political move? Father Thomas Rees, a Jesuit priest and a senior fellow at the Woodstock Theological Center at Georgetown University, argues that, if anything, the Vatican's offer is meant to be conciliatory.
I think what's basically happening is that there is a large number of Anglicans who have approached the Catholic Church and want to rejoin with the Catholic Church. You know, it's not that the Catholic Church is going out recruiting, trying to steal sheep from the Anglican Communion. These people are basically ones who are unhappy, have left, or are planning to leave the Anglican Communion. They're knocking on our door. And the question is, do we open the door and let them in, or do we say, no, thanks, you're on your own?
Yeah, but, I mean, they have that option, and they have had that option. I mean, why codify it?
Absolutely. And we've had people joining the Catholic Church from the Anglican Communion, and we've had Catholics joining the Anglican Church. We've had people going both ways. What is different with this is that we now have a process and a structure that will allow the Anglicans to keep their traditions, keep their spirituality, keep their liturgy as members of the Catholic Church, and also be allowed to keep their married clergy. So it's an act of respect towards the Anglican tradition and allowing room for it within the Catholic community.
An act of respect, you say, but as we heard earlier from Jim Naughton, an affront.
Well, I mean, this is the way that some people see it, and that's sad, but I don't think that's really the intention of the Vatican and the Catholic Church. They also want to continue to have dialogue. We want to continue to have good relations with the Anglican Communion. I mean, eventually we want to have union with the entire Anglican Communion. But right now, that's not foreseeable possibility in the near future, and we have these people knocking on our door, and the question is, what do we do with them?
Father Rees, do you think that this is a decision that will benefit the Catholic Church?
Well, I think it's a toss-up. If it ends up being something that hurts our relationship with the entire Anglican community, I think that's problematic. On the other hand, it's raising all sorts of issues for Catholics. For example, if a large number of married Anglican priests cross over and are ordained and act as married clergy in the Catholic Church, this is going to raise questions for regular Catholics about, well, why can't we have a married clergy, especially if we continue to have a decline in the number of clergy? This raises these kinds of questions once again in the Catholic community, questions that the Vatican does not want raised.
Father Thomas Rees is a senior fellow at the Woodstock Theological Center at Georgetown University. He joined me here in the studio. Thanks so much for taking the time.
You're welcome.
The question, of course, is how many Anglicans will take advantage of the Vatican's overture. Archbishop Robert Duncan broke with the official North American Episcopal Church 2 years ago over issues like the ordination of female bishops and gay marriage. In response, he helped found the conservative Anglican Church in North America.
What's remarkable is that the Vatican has said that this tradition really is a Catholic tradition, and the Vatican is prepared to take this tradition and make it possible for those who actually want to be under the Catholic Church. There are, of course, doctrinal differences that separate Anglicans from Roman Catholics, and in fact, it's those relatively few but significant doctrinal differences that will keep most of the Anglicans thankful about the Vatican's offer but not actually taking up on it.
Mm-hmm. Well, we spoke with a representative from the Episcopal Church here in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
He called the decision by the Vatican an affront.
Ah, an affront. Well, you see that the majority of Anglicans all over the world believe what the American Episcopal Church has done is an affront. It's an affront to what Christians have always believed. It's an affront to the authority of Holy Scripture. It's an affront to Christian marriage. It's an affront to the person and saving work of Jesus Christ. So it doesn't surprise me that a representative of the Episcopal Church would call what the Vatican has done an affront. They would, in fact, call what we have done as classic Anglicans, mainstream Anglicans, they'd call what we'd done an affront.
Do you have any plans to take advantage of the Vatican's offer?
No. I have made plain in my conversations with the Vatican that I believe that at this point in time, I'm called to lead the Anglican Church in North America and to rally faithful mainstream Anglicans together and together with other mainstream Christians, and that's my call and my work right now. But I certainly bless those who are ready for this.
Archbishop Robert Duncan heads the Anglican Church in North America. Your Grace, thank you so much.
God bless you. It's wonderful to talk with you.
We also spoke with former Catholic nun and author Karen Armstrong. She calls the Vatican's decision a distraction from the true message of Christ.
the faith traditions, all of them, every single one, insist that compassion and charity and the golden rule, don't do to others as you would not have them do to you, is at the centre and heart of religion. And I remember very clearly during the intensely acrimonious debate here in London about the possibility of ordaining women some years back, the then Bishop of Durham got up and said with tears in his voice that it was a scandal that here they were uttering this vicious abuse at one another in the full glare of the media, when there was a world out there torn apart, lost, longing for the compassionate message of religion to be articulated. I think that's what distresses me.
That's religious scholar Karen Armstrong.
Music video games are among the world's most popular, earning billions of dollars, selling to gamers who delight in shredding through a song by Jimi Hendrix or Aerosmith. NPR's Netta Ulaby says the company that makes Guitar Hero is tweaking that franchise with a new game that comes out tomorrow.
The game is called DJ Hero, and it's about as true to actual DJing as Guitar Hero is to actual rock stardom. Jamie Jackson is creative director of Freestyle Games, that developed both DJ and Guitar Hero.
It's not about you being a DJ and simulating. That wasn't the idea. It's about having fun and feeling like you're controlling the party. So all the music is pre-made by our DJs.
Meaning it's a pre-mixed, pre-sampled, pre-beat-matched assortment of popular tunes. Freestyle developers worked with about 20 DJs to figure out how to turn turntabling into something playable on an Xbox. It works like Guitar Hero, but instead of that plastic guitar, you get a fake turntable and a fake little mixer, while a funky DJ avatar struts, cuts, and scratches on screen.
He is enjoying himself.
Robert Carter is a DJ who plays nationally under the name DJ Cousin B. By day, you'll find him including audio for NPR's website. I asked him to play DJ Hero.
It takes some getting used to, but then again, this is a game.
Freestyle Games recruited a few illustrious DJs to add cred.
It's your boy, DJ Grandmaster Flash. I'm going to be a professor.
Okay, you got Flash on here, okay. So it's official.
Now let's talk about tapping.
I've never had Flash teach me how to DJ, so let's do it.
We decided to pit DJ Cousin B against a gamer, NPR intern Brian Reardon.
You're overthinking it. You just got to move it. Just moving it back and forth.
Ah, yeah, I'm overthinking it. I'm at an NPR, not the club.
DJ Cousin B was experiencing the same problems some guitar players have with Guitar Hero. Real skills don't translate. They confuse you.
That's weird. Because you normally don't scratch with just one finger, so it's really strange, but okay.
When Freestyle Games first developed DJ Hero, creative director Jamie Jackson asked regular people what they thought DJs did.
99% of them put one hand to their ear and the other made a scratching sound and kind of went, wicka, wicka, wicka.
See, I mean, I don't know anything about turntables, and I'm sure, like I have no idea what this, I've never known what guys are doing when they do that.
Gamer Brian Reardon still utterly destroys the DJ in this virtual battle. Robert Carter is a fabulous DJ in real life. He's not fabulous at scoring points in the game's glamorous industrial nightclub.
You are just stinking up the joint.
They just booed me.
Oh, you didn't even get one star.
I didn't get a star, man. They booed me.
Is there anything about this that's like actual DJing?
DJs fantasize for an environment like this. You have about 30,000 people out there going crazy. I mean, it's everybody's reacting. No fights out there.
DJ Cousin B, a.k.a. Robert Carter, says this game is perfect if you want to one-up a DJ.
Say, man, like, you know, I think you would be nice at DJ Hero. Let me check you out. And you just kill him.
Still, Carter plans to get the game for his little 8-year-old nephew. In a few years, he says, he'll teach him how to DJ for real. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.